I'm delighted to be joined today by Jim Weiss, who, when I first began our adventures with Professor Carroll, was one of the initial figures I came to know, a person who wove stories and taught people how to give the art of storytelling to their children. And I have to say to you, Jim Weiss, you've been such a great mentor to the work we've done here. So first of all, welcome and thank you.
Thank you very much. And I should be welcoming you since we're actually recording this in my studio in Virginia. So welcome right back at you,
Thank
Carol.
You for opening this to us. This is really fun because every time I think of you, I think about how, first of all, how lucky I am to have heard your stories. Because actually, the first time I did hear you was in a workshop where you were teaching parents how to tell a story. And you had started with a story. And I thought, wow, you know, I need to know more about this. But also, I always have questions I wish I could ask you. And now's my chance, right?
Go for it. That's what we're here for, and I'm just delighted to be part of this. And since you've been so nice, I should note the fact that I love your work, and I love the passion you bring to it too. You know, and as I said to you earlier when we were talking before we actually began to record, the two consistent threads through my whole life personally have been stories and music. So this is a fun session to be sharing with you. What's up? What do you want to know?
Well, one thing, we were discussing some of this earlier as well. You and I know what storytelling means, and you and I know what we might be tempted to call, you know, traditional authentic experience with music, acoustical music that one makes, that one hears, mean. Mm-hmm. But we're living in a time where everything is digital and visual and instant.
Yeah.
So do you fear for the fate of the story, or how do you see storytelling in the here and now?
Well, first of all, I think you're right about the nature of this being a very visual age in general. So one thing I want to say is that, just setting aside everything else for a moment, it's very important for people to develop listening skills. And if there's always a picture attached to the story or whatever it may be, you don't. And one of the things that the brain researchers have determined in the last 10 or 15 years is they've been able to actually delve into the physiological changes happening in people's brains when they listen to music or listen to stories, is that you're talking about two entirely different parts of the brain. If I tell you a story and give you a visual image to go with it on a movie screen or a TV screen, computer screen, a stage, or versus if I tell you a story or read a story to you out loud, or you're reading it yourself and you, in your imagination, are filling in the visual images. And each of those parts of the brain is involved with different kinds of creative thinking. And just the way you pump iron to build up your biceps, you have to pump brain. And so in a very visual age, it's important to do both. I'm not one of those people who says, go out and shoot your television set. That has a place too. But you want to do both. And later on, the person that is raised this way is going to be able to call on both of those parts of his or her brain, and the brain will be ready to go. So, first of all, I think it's important to be aware of that. Second, story is story. Now, it may come to us in different form. I think motion pictures are a great vehicle for story, but motion pictures also have that visual thing. And the great filmmakers will sometimes set aside dialogue to show something happening. I remember Buster Keaton wrote something about how he and Charlie Chaplin, who were great friends, you know, the two great silent film comics, and they decided to have a contest to see which of them could make a film of a certain length with the fewest number of those little visual screens where they would show the dialogue or the narration. And Keaton says that his friend Charlie never forgave him because he beat him. He had one less screen on his film than Chaplin did. But these people were great visual artists. And actually, when Chaplin tried to make the switch over to spoken word, he wasn't as good at it. Because his way of telling a story was so visual. There's a wonderful story about Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn and I think Laurence Olivier and Vivien Leigh, and they were having dinner one night at one of their homes, and they were airing one of Chaplin's films that had spoken dialogue, and none of them liked it very much. When it was over, they said, gee, that was disappointing for this genius. And Tracy, who was so astute, said, wait a minute, we're going to watch it again. I'm turning off the sound. And they loved the movie. So Chaplin's way of telling the story was through movement. Mine is through words. You talk about people who tell stories or communicate through music and other arts, too. They're all important. I think that reading aloud or telling stories, if you're comfortable just telling them in your own words, is a very vital part of development. And what's interesting about story is, and this is another of the things the brain researchers have discovered, you not only learn stories, you learn how to learn. Because when you are learning stories without realizing it, you are learning how to differentiate between the main points and the supportive details in a story. You don't even know you're learning that, but you're learning it. And you then begin to apply that to other things that you're studying. I'm going on about this, but I hope that's okay.
Well, no, you're the master storyteller. That's why I'm asking you this question.
Years ago, we got a phone call from a school district in one of the poorest sections of the country. And the teachers called our office and said, we love your work. Some of us have seen you in person. The kids in our school district are all at or below the federal poverty level. A lot of their parents don't speak English. They're immigrants. Or they're not literate. They don't know how to read. These kids have never heard stories of the kinds that you tell, stories from history, stories from classic literature, and they don't know what they're missing. Mm-hmm. Could you come down for a whole week and just tell stories? So I said, I'd be honored. So I went into the situation knowing that these children did not know the same stories that, Carol, your listeners' children would know at the same ages. What I didn't count on was this. Halfway through the first assembly, I realized not only did these children not know the stories I was telling, they had no experience with stories, period. They hadn't been introduced to stories.
So how could you tell that? What did you see or what did you feel?
I can sense a lot visually and in the energy of a room. It's part of being a performer for me. And what it told me right away was not only did I have to give more details in the telling of a story, I had to be very careful about how I structured it to bring out the main points. And to a degree, at least in the first go-round, to have fewer supportive details because these kids couldn't tell the difference. Which meant if you were a parent or a teacher, you could be with one of these kids all day long teaching them about a subject, not just a story, any subject, and they wouldn't know the main points from the details you might throw in just to add some texture or color or depth. They hadn't learned how to learn. Their brains weren't working that way altogether yet. And so I had fewer of those supporting details. I had to tell differently. Now, one of the differences between a great author or storyteller and an amateur or a beginner, and this is true of any art actually, is knowing not only what to put into the story, but what to leave out. And Hemingway always said he knew his novel was done when he had taken out everything he felt he could take out. And you know this about your composers, too. At the British Museum, they have some of Beethoven's manuscripts, you know, which is mind-boggling. And you're looking at these things. You've seen those.
They're a mess, yeah.
Yeah, they are totally a mess. Because, well, first of all, he didn't have software, you know. Today, we probably only see the finished piece. But in these paper manuscripts, you can see the stuff, the 40 different versions of da-da-da-da that he was trying. They also have Paul McCartney's manuscript of the song Yesterday, the Beatles song, and some of John Lennon's lyrics too, and you can see how they scratched things out or tried two or three different alternatives. But that's part of the art. So the thing is that the amateur will leave in so many details that get in the way of the flow. And if you're fortunate, you will learn some things that are fairly simple stories, which is why folk tales and fairy tales, among other things, are important, because they tend to be kind of stripped down. And then you can go on to more complex things. That was a very long answer for a very short question.
Oh, well, it was filled with richness. And I'm thinking now about, because again, thinking about families and the daily life and the busyness and how tired people get in the evenings and how busy our weekends are and on and on and on. If you think of a story as being unimportant, and we hope people don't, but seeing it as the strong cultural tie that it is between mm-hmm. the generations throughout the line of history, stories may seem fragile on a moment-to-moment or dispensable or some kind of a mm-hmm. frill or a luxury, but they're actually one of the strongest elements of cultural tradition. Is that a fair statement?
The way that a family or an entire culture hands down the things it truly believes in is through our stories. And not the stuff we say we believe in, the stuff we truly believe in is reflected in our stories. And stories both reflect a culture and help to shape it also. I can think of examples, and you could too, of themes coming out in film or on TV or in books. And you begin to see a change in the perception of the public towards a particular subject that is kind of being worked out by the artists in the culture through their work. But there's more to it than that. You know, we've been talking on a deep level, but the other piece of it, two pieces, I guess, are, number one, it's really fun to share stories. And you should only share the stories you love yourself, because otherwise they'll fall flat and your kids won't be turned on to stories. Whereas if you are excited, they'll get excited by the idea of stories, or in your case, Carol, also music, visual arts, all the rest. But the other piece of it is, if you share the stories you care about, people sense this and they respond really well. It's one of the strongest opportunities you have for forming a bond between two people. If you tell a story to somebody else, one you're passionate for, people sense that and they tend to really honor it. Audiences don't want to see you fail, whether it's your own child or playing in some big opera house somewhere with, you know, hundreds or thousands of people. They're on your side, and particularly if they see that you care about what you're doing. And for a parent and a child, sharing stories is just astoundingly powerful as a bonding tool. Also because at some point your child may start to tell you a story, and it gives you the opportunity to honor them right back.
Because I'm so glad you said that, because I wanted to ask that immediately. When a child comes in and tells you a story of what just happened in the backyard, what are there differences in terms of your looking with your specialization at mm-hmm. how a child tells a story back to an adult? How does that work? How does that work out as they transform?
Well, first of all, most kids tend to be pretty natural at some sort of storytelling. We all storytelling. You know, if I say to you, gee, I know you read such and such a book. What's that about? You can watch somebody just drop right into storytelling mode, and they'll say, if they're not those kids I was just talking about a few minutes ago, if they've experienced story, there'll be a moment's pause, and they'll say, okay, well, it's a story about, and they'll tell you who the main character is, or characters might be. They'll set the time and the place if it's something different from this time and place. They'll tell you the challenges the person faces and how they deal with it and the ending, which is actually, in a nutshell, what happens in a story. When kids are just learning to be comfortable with it, sometimes their idea of a story is, well, we went to the park and I played in the sandbox and I went on the swings, and it's just a line a linear recitation of these are the six things we did. There isn't a I'm facing challenges kind of a thing the way there is in the classical structure of a story. But you don't want to stop a child and say, no, this is how you should do it, honey, tell it like this. You just want to be encouraging somebody to feel she or he can come to you and tell you something like this. Eventually, they'll start to see it for themselves. Or you can make it more conscious when you're talking about one of your own stories, and it'll start to reflect back when they come next time to you to tell you stories. They'll start to follow a structure. But you never want to say, well, that was great, but. Just the way when you tell somebody, you know, write me something just for fun. You don't want to sit and correct the spelling or the punctuation. There is a time and a place for that, which is, and those things are vital. But that's different from, can you tell me a story? And I think it was Sherwood Anderson who won, was it the Pulitzer or the Nobel, and who couldn't spell to save his life. And he used to say, before I'd send a book off to my publisher, my wife and my mother would take my manuscript and correct it. And here's this world-famous author, right? And he'd say, I could hear them in the other room laughing uproariously at my stupidity because I couldn't remember whether this usage of there was T-H-E-R-E or T-H-E-I-R or whether it should have been T-H-A-R-E. I had no idea. I loved that anecdote. I loved it because it's a spelling. Spelling is important, but it's a different thing.
And it wasn't his gift. And he didn't have time for it. And his creative process must have been racing on a level at times, you know, that didn't even allow you to stop to do that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and that's why people rewrite, too, is you go back and correct things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an intricate world. It's a beautiful world as a musician. Obviously, I think a lot about stories within opera and drama and things on the stage. And if I get a chance one day, I'm going to ask you more about your love of music. But for right now, I want to thank you very much for talking to us.
I just want to add that you don't have to be, first of all, some famous storyteller to share stories with your kids. And if you are not comfortable telling a story in your own words, listen. Holding a book and setting the example of holding a book and reading aloud to your child is as valuable a thing as you can do. If you're comfortable doing both, one story you might tell, one you might read. And by the way, if you're reading a book to your child and you say, I think my child would love this story, but there's this one part that gets too intense or he might be confused by this one part, you know what? Give yourself permission to paraphrase that one page.
Leave it out, right.
Or either leave it out or tell it in a way that's not as scary or as violent or that clarifies the point in words your child can understand. You're not doing a disservice to the child. You're giving the child a story he might not otherwise get for another 5 or 6 years. When he rereads the book himself years later, fine, he'll get that. But for now, you're translating that material to your child's level. So make it something that works for him or her as well as for yourself.
Because that's what we do with foods. We puree them at first and we make them in palatable forms for the age. I mean, I know that's a funny thing to think about,
no,
but we just don't hand a child a corn on the cob when they're, you know,
they're
14 months old. If they have no teeth, right? So, I mean, it's such a... Well, that's another thing I like to talk about, too, is food and the arts, because they seem to have so many parallels. It's always wonderful to speak with you. Thank you.
You're welcome, Carol. Thanks for asking me.